the boar while being fired and flew out at some small angle. Not a severe one, but often enough to make it hook or slice like a golf ball, and almost impossible to put on a bullseye. When cannonballs did find their targets, they could cause devastating damage. Weighing at least 6 pounds, and often much more, they could tear through the thick hulls and masts of enemy ships, sending huge wood splinters flying into anything and anyone nearby. Matera was surprised to learn that the secondary impact from splinters was the cause of most human casualties from naval cannon fire. Slower flying cannonballs often did the most damage because they didn't penetrate as cleanly through wood, which meant cannons fired from a distance might be the deadliest of them all. To Matera, it was clear that the Navy captains chose to fight up close. According to records, they'd been hit by musket fire. That wouldn't have happened if the frigates had been more than about 150 yards from the island. But that was the outer range of effective musket fire. When Matera envisioned the start of the battle, he saw the two sides even closer than that. Closing in on the Golden Fleece at the island, the frigates would have turned sideways, broadside, to fire. Most of their cannons were positioned along the ship's sides, and while this made them a bigger target when fighting, it also allowed them to deliver maximum fire. This is how navies were built to do battle in the Age of Sail, broadside to broadside, a brutal and close-up affair. Matera knew from the records that Bannister fired first, but it wouldn't have taken long for the gunners aboard the frigates to throw open the ship's shuttered gun ports and bring their guns to bear. Operating cannons was a muscular and dangerous business. Lives depended on which side could do it best. Most cannons of the day were made of cast iron and fired round iron balls. Many guns were named for the size of their shot, hence, a cannon that fired a 12-pound ball was called simply a 12-pounder. The Falcon carried 12-pounders, 6-pounders, and a few Sakers, cannons that fired balls weighing 5 1/4 pounds. The Drake was more lightly armed, having several Sakers and some 3-pounders. Bannister likely had some of them all. He would have carried several as a merchant captain, and no doubt had been stealing more since he turned pirate. Whatever the caliber, the weapons could inflict devastating damage to enemy ships and personnel. It was the job of each cannon crew, often comprising 3 or 4 men, to make sure its own gun delivered. Matera hardly could imagine a better showdown than the one between the Navy and pirate gunners. The Navy seamen were better trained, but the pirates had the high ground, and didn't have to fire from a moving ship. On board the frigates, boys as young as 10 ran gunpowder from dry holds below decks up to the gunners. Most often the powder was contained in a sausage-shaped canvas bag known as the cartridge, which was loaded into the bore of the cannon. The size of the cartridge depended on the size of the ball to be fired. Usually the gunpowder weighed a little more than half what the cannonball did. A 12-pounder, for example, would require about 7 pounds of gunpowder. Wadding, made from old rope or canvas, was pushed in after the powder, then shoved down to the breech, rear, along with the cartridge, by a long piece of wood called a rammer. Next, the cannonball was loaded, followed by more wadding and ramming. Now the gun captain took center stage. Careful not to cause sparks, he pushed an iron poker into the cannon's vent, a small exhaust hole near the breech, puncturing the gunpowder cartridge inside. Then, using a much finer gunpowder known as serpentine, he filled the vent to the top. Only then was the weapon ready to fire. Pulling on thick ropes attached to the gun's wheeled carriage, the Navy crew muscled the cannon forward until its barrel protruded out of its port. Now, despite the pitch and roll of the ship, despite the concussion of other cannons, despite taking enemy fire, the gun crew aimed as best they could. All that remained was for the gun captain to step forward with his linstock, a long pole with a smoldering match at the end, and put it to the touch hole, and the weapon would fire. If ever there was a time to pray, it was now. A cannon, even loaded properly, could explode on firing, killing anyone in the vicinity. Back blasts could burn, deafen, or concuss nearby crewmen. Open gun ports made gunners more vulnerable to enemy cannon fire. Even if perfectly fired, a 3,000-pound cannon's violent recoil could crush a slow-footed crewman who failed to get out of its way. Moving the match to the touch hole, the gun captain ignited the serpentine powder. A moment later, the world thundered as a black ball, yellow flame, and gray-white smoke shot from the cannon's mouth, and the gun flew back in protest, held down only by ropes tied to the ship's inner hull. On the island, pirates with good eyes might see the cannonball streaking at more than 700 miles per hour toward the Golden Fleece, or toward themselves. At the same time, shooters on both sides loaded their muskets, a process similar to loading the cannons, complete with wadding and rammers, and took aim at their targets. The effective range of these long-barreled guns was little more than 100 yards, but no one was looking for bullseyes. Instead, they would have fired in volley, sending dozens of shots at once in the general direction of the enemy. Just one heavy lead ball could tear off a man's arm. Dozens raining down from the sky could test even the bravest man's courage. The battle was on. To destroy the Golden Fleece and the pirates' gun emplacements, the Navy gunners likely fired classic round cannonballs. Against people, however, they might have fired any number of nasty variants, including chain shot, two balls or half balls connected by chain, bar shot, similar to chain shot but connected by a bar, and canister shot, metal cans of musket balls or rocks that sprayed shrapnel. Returning fire, the pirates probably used round cannonballs aimed at the frigate's hulls and masts. By now, the Navy warships were likely anchored at both ends to keep them steady and fighting near to each other, bringing the maximum amount of firepower to bear on Bannister and his crew. It was rare, during the Age of Sail, for ships to fire full broadsides all at once, because it strained the timbers of the vessel. But both the Falcon and the Drake likely fired several of their guns together, pummeling the island and whatever targets they could find. It was essential for the frigates to take out the pirate cannon batteries, which Matera believed had been placed by Bannister at the top of the eastern tip of the island. The elevation alone, more than 100 feet over the shoreline, would have made aiming heavy cannons on the frigates even more difficult through narrow gun ports. Often, to aim high, a ship had to anchor farther away from its target, thereby reducing its accuracy. To Matera, elevation alone meant advantage. But perhaps the biggest problem in hitting the pirates with cannon fire came from the pitching and rolling of the ships. Fighting from the water, cannoneers often had to wait until the moment their vessel came level to fire. In this way, they were aiming the ship more than the guns. Both sides likely missed with most of their shots. Those that connected, however, would have done grave harm. The Golden Fleece, minus at least half her guns, which had been moved onto the island, and possibly still careened on the sand, was likely damaged early on, though she might have been unmanned during the battering. Navy seamen struck by musket balls and wood splinters would have begun to fall. Those hit in the head or neck or torso often died immediately if they were lucky. The injured who survived were moved to the ship's surgeon or barber for bandaging or, if the wounds were more serious, amputation. It was here, before the surgeon and his saw, that the grievously injured man's fate would be decided. Seamen doing battle in the 17th century expected to lose limbs. Navy surgeons had seen every gruesome injury and removed mangled arms and legs often. By Bannister's time, there were few places in the world more advanced in trauma surgery than the dank and unsterile quarters of a Navy fighting ship. If one had to be separated from a part of his body, this was the place to be. Amputations were performed frequently, but the surgeons did not go into them lightly. The operation cannot be performed without putting the patient to violent and inexpressible pain, wrote Pierre Dionis, a prominent French surgeon of the time and author of a surgical textbook. Nor were surgeons under any illusions about the outcomes. There was a good chance a patient would die after amputation, but he was near certain he would die without it. So they did what had to be done. Speed was paramount. Delay increased the risk of blood loss, infection, shock, and delirium. It often exposed the patient and his wound to onboard nibbling rats, and it allowed him to contemplate what was to happen on the operating table. Sometimes the imagination could be even crueler than the bone saw. Delay also deprived the surgeon of perhaps his most effective tool, the patient's own adrenaline. That hormone, in addition to acting as a painkiller, could provide a man courage, and he would need it, because in the late 17th century, there was no anesthetic. At best, a man might be given a bit of alcohol to drink, and then not too much for fear it might inflame rather than calm him. Shipboard surgeons had little time to explain amputation to injured men, but what they said was likely honest and direct. John Woodall, an English author of an early 17th century text on surgery, recommended, "If you be constrained to use your saw, let first your patient be well informed of the imminent danger of death by the use thereof. Prescribe him no certainty of life, and let the work be done with his own free will and request, and not otherwise." The patient would have to be held down. For this, the surgeon called on several assistants, the stronger the better. Moving the wounded man onto the operating table, often just a board balanced on two chests and covered by a piece of canvas, the assistants would take their positions and plant their feet. One held the patient from behind, others restrained his extremities, and still another held down the ruined limb, often over the edge of the table so that the surgeon could do his work. Until now, the surgeon had taken great pains not to show the patient his tools. Sometimes the sight of a bone saw or curved knife could be more terrible than the cut itself. Only after the patient had been secured would the surgeon bring out his instruments. They included an amputation knife, a bone saw, forceps, needles, bandages, and cauterizing implements. They were made as clean as possible for the time, often with a mixture of vinegar and water. Many surgeons chose to include a bit of healthy flesh above the wound to ensure removal of all damaged tissue and bone. No one, however, wanted to take more of the patient's limb than was necessary. Having chosen the spot, the surgeon tied on a tourniquet, perhaps a rag torn from the patient's own clothes, then steadied himself against the movement of the ship. Every surgeon hoped to make a quick, clean cut, but that could be interrupted by the temper of the sea. The surgeon first went to work with his knife, making a circular cut through to the bone and fully around the limb, clearing the way for the bone saw. If possible, he would do it in just two strokes, one on top, the other underneath, a procedure that might take just a minute or two if done right. By now the pain would have been excruciating for the patient. Some would have gone into shock. Trading knife for saw, the surgeon went to work on the bone. Using gentle strokes at first, he made sure the teeth took hold, then used long, powerful strokes to cut through the bone, as clean and as fast as he could. Only when it was nearly severed did he revert back to gentle strokes to prevent the bone from splintering. When the limb finally came free, the surgeon, or an assistant, tossed it into a nearby bucket of water or sawdust, which might still contain the severed parts of previous patients. The contents of the bucket would be thrown overboard and likely eaten by sharks. Now the surgeon had to stop the bleeding, not just because the patient could die from it, but because the sight of it could overwhelm him. To do so, the surgeon cauterized the wound with medicines, acids, blazing irons, or binds. Next, he stitched up the flesh, pulling extra skin over remaining bone, then bandaged it. If all had gone well, the amputation might be complete in under 5 minutes. If the ongoing battle was hot, as it likely was between Bannister's men and the frigates, the surgeon would have wiped down his tools, taken a breath, and called for the next man to be placed on his table. Having destroyed the Golden Fleece, the frigates were free to direct the full force of their fire on the small ship Bannister was reported to have with him, and on the pirates themselves. But now, Matera could see it. The Royal Navy could fire forever, and it still would be difficult to kill Bannister's men. Dug in behind sand, mud, and trees, the pirates were protected from cannon and musket fire, which were absorbed with little more than a thud. And that's how it must have gone for the next few hours. Navy seamen shooting and dying from their powerful ships, but unable to put down the pirates. On board the frigates, supplies of powder and shot dwindled, and hulls and masts were battered and damaged by pirate cannon fire. To the Navy captains, it had to look like Bannister, who was standing just across the channel, was oceans beyond their reach. Unless they got to the island. By storming the shore, the frigate crews could engage the pirates hand to hand, using swords, pistols, muskets, pikes, hatchets, and fists to do what their cannons could not. Better trained than Bannister's men, and outnumbering them by at least 2-1, the Navy was likely to decimate the pirates in any face-to-face meeting on the island. The problem was getting there. The frigates were too big to sail into the shallow water at shore. That meant crewmen would have to row to the island in longboats, perhaps 30 to a vessel, leaving them virtually helpless against sniper fire, a miniature version of Omaha Beach. The Royal Navy prided itself on its willingness to fight, even under brutal conditions. Suicide, however, was another matter. If Talbot and Spragg considered a landing, they likely didn't consider it for long. Instead, the Navy seamen reloaded their weapons and pounded the island wherever they saw evidence, mostly from smoke and flames, of pirate gunfire. In this era, the rate of cannon fire was slow. It took 5 or 6 minutes for gunners to reload. But it was not imperative that the frigates fire rapidly, as the pirates no longer had a means of escape, now that the Golden Fleece had been battered. Instead, the gunners strived to be accurate, to whatever extent that was possible. All the while, the pirates fired back. It didn't need to be much, just enough for Bannister to remind the Navy he was still armed and supplied, and to wear them down and to keep them from storming the island. As darkness settled over Samana Bay, the fighting would have died down. It made little sense for either side to spend powder and shot on targets they couldn't see. But both sides would have maintained a continuous watch. Navy crews would have gone to work repairing damage and preparing for the battle yet to come. During breaks, they probably wolfed down salt beef, salt fish, salt pork, peas, cheese, biscuits, often infested by weevils, and beer, 1 gallon per man per day. If there were even a few minutes for sleep, they took it. It might have been during the night that the Navy tended to its dead. The English were religious and would have done all they could to perform a burial service. Given the size of the crews aboard the frigates, about 180 on the Falcon, about 75 on the Drake, there likely was at least one chaplain between them. To the best of his abilities, that chaplain would have performed some kind of service. Crewmen would have doffed their caps as the bodies were pushed overboard. Matera couldn't wait to read more, but the library closed. So he met his childhood friend, John Bellotti, at Elaine's, the famed restaurant near 2nd Avenue and 88th Street in Manhattan. They ordered mussels and clams, and Matera described all he'd learned about the drama of doing battle at sea in the 17th century. Matera and Bellotti agreed that the Royal Navy was one hell of a tough outfit, but neither man would have joined that crew in the 17th century. "We would have been pirates," Bellotti said. "We were pirates once," Matera replied. When it came time to leave, Bellotti asked Matera how things were going. Matera could not lie to his friend. He was hemorrhaging money with nothing to show for it. He was working with an old man who wouldn't get out of his way, and his partner was losing his mind. "I know you don't quit," Bellotti said, "and I'm not saying you should, but you and I both know sometimes a guy's got to get out." For a moment, Matera didn't know what to say. Then he told his friend that in a few months he was going to turn 47, the age at which his father died. "So I can't quit now," he said. Matera resumed his research the next morning, just as the Royal Navy crews resumed their fight. Talbot and Spragg had to make a decision. They'd done their best to sink the Golden Fleece, but they also had orders to capture or kill Bannister. They could do that more easily by drawing closer to the pirates, but they risked further damage to the frigates if they dared. Historical accounts didn't say how close the frigates moved in on the second day of the fighting, but Matera knew one thing for certain. The Navy seamen stayed on their guns, slugging it out, firing cannons and muskets, suffering more casualties, until evening came and the frigates ran out of gunpowder and shot. It was then that Captains Talbot and Spragg made the only decision they could: sail back to Jamaica and plead their case to the governor. Molesworth would not be happy. The frigates had suffered 23 dead and wounded, and no one had laid a hand on Bannister. That kind of failure might cost the captains their lives. On return to Port Royal, Talbot and Spragg were much censured, but spared more serious punishment. Molesworth must have concluded that they'd unleashed hell on the island and done all they could, because the two men's careers continued, as Bannister later would find out. Packing up a pile of photocopied papers and notes, Matera left the New York Public Library and caught a taxi to the airport. He felt like he'd just left the battlefield himself. He met Chatterton a few evenings later in Samana. He described what he'd brought back from New York, a historically accurate vision of the fight between Bannister's pirates and the Royal Navy frigates. Chatterton sat riveted. But he knew Matera hadn't made the trip to New York just for a story.
"So what's the upshot here?" Chatterton asked.
"I don't know yet," Matera said, "but I'm close." The next afternoon, Carolina arrived for a visit, but Matera was still working. He'd asked Kretschmer to meet him at the dive center just below the villa. He sensed that Kretschmer, fed up with the tension among the crew and months of fruitless searches, was about to quit for good, and he couldn't afford to lose him. When Matera arrived, he could see Kretschmer already in the shed at work on an engine. Matera didn't want to go in just yet. He needed to use the right words with Kretschmer, so he stood on the beach to think it over. Across the channel, he could see the spot where the Golden Fleece would have careened, the woods where pirate snipers would have hidden, the hill on the eastern edge where Bannister would have placed his cannons. And then he saw something he'd never seen before.
"Heiko!"
he yelled. Kretschmer came running from the shed.
"Drop everything," Matera told him. "Get Carolina. She's up in the villa. I see it now. I know where to look."
Chapter 17. Another Way. Matera and Carolina waded into the water and walked to the Zodiac, carrying a picnic basket full of sandwiches, wine, cold water, and suntan lotion. On board, they joined Kretschmer, who had already loaded his share of picnic treats, a handheld metal detector, a shovel, and a hatchet. Matera carried two cameras around his neck. Carolina wore a giant floppy hat. Driving the Zodiac at tourist speed, they headed across the channel toward the eastern end of Cayo Vigia. They landed on a tiny section of sand, unloaded their gear, and did their best to look like they'd come from the nearby resort. Carolina posed for Kretschmer's snapshots. Matera assembled a fishing pole. When they were sure no one was looking, they ducked into the dense woods and began hiking up the steep hill. It took 20 minutes for them to fight their way past tangled overgrowth and bird-sized insects to a point more than 100 feet over the water. Looking out over the channel, Matera could see the world through Bannister's eyes. In all the Caribbean, there was no better place to careen a ship or to win an unwinnable battle. From here, pirate cannons could hit any target, but anyone shooting back would be doing it blind. Kretschmer assembled the metal detector and put on the headphones. Running the unit over mud and brush, he listened for hits, but heard nothing. The group pulled themselves through the overgrowth, trying to suck in the bits of fresh air that managed to penetrate the dense jungle. Even Carolina was sweating now, but the group kept moving, bent over and dripping, all of it a fevered dream. Kretschmer stopped.
"I've got something," he said.
He moved the metal detector slowly over a patch of dirt and mud about 3 feet square. Beeps in his ear adjusted his aim until he arrived at a spot.
Here, Kretschmer said.
Matera grabbed the shovel, Kretschmer the hatchet, and the men went to work, digging on hands and knees. As the hole got bigger, Kretschmer pushed the metal detector down into it to refine the direction of the dig, but no matter how much dirt they removed, there was more underneath. They kept at it for 30 minutes, digging, chopping at roots, listening to the metal detector, and digging again, until the blade of the shovel finally collided with something solid at a depth of about a foot. Something it couldn't move.
Whoa, 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 Matera said.
Now, using a hand spade, Kretschmer chipped away sections of dirt from the sides of the hole until a shape began to emerge. A little less black than the mud, but as round as the top of the moon.
There it is, Matera said.
Wedging the hatchet behind the object, Kretschmer muscled and leveraged until the thing finally came loose. All three picnickers stared into the hole. Lying free at the bottom was a 6-pound cannonball.
The last time someone touched that was in 1686, Matera said.
He reached into the hole and pulled out the cannonball. The weight startled him. He could tell it was a 6-pounder, but only by holding it could he feel its destructive potential. The group celebrated with hugs, kisses, Kretschmer wiped off Matera's, and a glass of wine. Carolina spread out the blanket she'd brought so they could sit and enjoy a toast. Kretschmer wondered aloud if Bannister could have imagined this scene, two treasure hunters and a beautiful woman drinking wine on the site of his battle. Matera assured him that Bannister could. When they finished, they hiked back down the hill, running the metal detector as they fought not to fall. Halfway down, they got another hit and dug up another cannonball, this one even bigger than the first. After everyone posed for photos with the cannonballs, the group made its way back to the beach, then across the bay to the villa. Matera dashed off an email to Chatterton. In the subject line, he wrote, "Buddy, we got it." But Chatterton wasn't there to receive it. He'd set out in the Range Rover to pick up supplies. On an unimproved road near the Back Bay and Samana, he'd hit a hole filled with jagged rock, tearing a gash into the sidewall of his tire. He managed to drive onto the beach, but when he tried to change the tire, the jack collapsed and bent, and the wheel sank up to its fender in sand. Chatterton checked his cell phone. No signal. It might be miles to the next town. He started walking. Down the road, he found four local men, one of them elderly, playing cards outside a small shop. They didn't have a jack, nor did they know where to find one, but told Chatterton they would help with his car. He tried to explain that the Range Rover was heavy, but they didn't seem to understand. Walking back to the vehicle, the elderly man motioned for Chatterton not to worry. The Dominican men studied the truck, muttering in Spanish too fast for Chatterton to understand. Soon they were gathering supplies, a large tree branch and a pile of rocks. "I'm in the Stone Age here," Chatterton thought. The men went to work. Using improvised levers and fulcrums and a big rock as a hammer, they bent the jack back into shape. No way, Chatterton thought, but soon the jack looked nearly new. When they got it under the truck, however, it gave way and collapsed again, this time beyond repair. Chatterton began to thank the Dominicans and reach into his pocket, but none of them wanted his money. Instead, they went out collecting again, farther away this time, bringing back heavy palm branches and giant rocks. Chatterton tried to explain that the jack couldn't be saved, but that's not what they had in mind. The men used the stems to dig a hole under the truck's strut assembly, then replaced sand with rocks. Chatterton grabbed his own leaf and jumped in to help them dig. A space began to open under the flat tire, and the truck's frame came to rest on its rock support. Now Chatterton could see the beauty of this plan. It was right in front of him. And it struck him that he'd often seen this kind of approach in Dominicans, that they rarely had what they needed, and often had nothing at all, but they didn't seem to notice that, or at least be much bothered by it. Instead, they focused on what they did have. If not a jack, then a branch. If not money, then time. Then cobbled together a solution, a different way of getting there. He'd long cursed their mañana culture, swore that these people were going nowhere because they didn't go at full speed. But as he watched the old man flip off the ruined tire and replace it with the spare, he could see what he'd admired about Dominicans all along. That they didn't worry for the future because they knew there was always a way to arrive. The men shoved piles of rocks under the truck to give it purchase, then Chatterton backed it off the beach. He insisted they take the money in his pocket, about $20, and they did.
Gracias, gracias.
Then walked back to where they came from, a place where they were dirt poor, able to figure their way as things came to them, looking happier than anyone Chatterton knew. It was morning before Chatterton received the cannonball photos from Matera. By that time, he was on his way to catch a flight to Miami to take care of personal matters he'd put off for too long. The flight lasted more than 2 hours, much of which he used to gaze at the images his partner had sent him. When he landed, he called Matera, who told him about the discovery and about how things looked from the top of the island. A worthy place for the veriest rogues in these Indies, as the governor of Jamaica had referred to Bannister and his crew. To both Chatterton and Matera, the cannonballs proved that the battle had occurred at Cayo Vigia, and that the so-called sugar wreck, located less than 200 yards off the island, was the Golden Fleece. It was imperative that Bowden resume salvage on the sugar wreck immediately, not just to prove the wreck's identity, but to put an end to the parade of interlopers at Cayo Levantado. Yet, Matera was reluctant to tell Bowden about the cannonballs. He knew Bowden didn't want anyone working on land, an area that went beyond his lease rights.
"Let me talk to him," Chatterton said. "I'll go in person."
Matera saw all kinds of risk in the idea. Chatterton could lose his cool and blow up at Bowden, or Bowden might become frustrated with Chatterton and finally pull the plug on the pirate quest. Until now, Matera had been a buffer between the two, but he'd be 800 miles away from this meeting. Still, he agreed to it.
"John, call me when the meeting's over and keep that famous Chatterton temper under control."
Chatterton laughed.
"What temper?"
He sat down with Bowden a day later at a Denny's restaurant in Miami and detailed Matera's adventure. He took Bowden all the way to the top of the hill at Cayo Vigia, just as Matera had described it to him. To Chatterton, Bowden looked more excited with every detail.
"How many cannonballs did Matera find?"
Bowden asked.
"Two.
In an hour.
Can you imagine what else is up there, Tracy? Weapons, bones, treasure, who knows?
Give the island to Cultura. They get shipwrecks all the time. They get galleons. How many pirate islands do they get?" Bowden looked uncomfortable. In the past, he'd warned Chatterton and Matera that his lease didn't extend to the land, and he didn't want to anger Dominican officials by working beyond the lease boundaries. But now, Chatterton tried to reassure him. At the end of the day, would Cultura really be upset with him for unraveling the mystery of a historic pirate battle?
"This is your island, Tracy," Chatterton said. "The Golden Fleece is your idea. Only now, you don't just have a pirate wreck to offer, you have a pirate camp. How many of those are there in the world? Give Cultura the island, and let's finish the sugar wreck."
But Bowden still didn't look sold, and Chatterton believed he knew why. The sugar wreck debris field lay in 44 feet of water. Treasure hunter William Phipps had seen the wreck of the Golden Fleece in 24 feet, just months after her sinking. That disparity, Bowden often had told Chatterton and Matera, troubled him.
"I don't think the sugar wreck is right," Bowden said.
Chatterton sat there for several moments.
"All right, Tracy," he said finally. "Thanks for your time."
From his car, Chatterton called Matera and reported on the meeting. It was clear, he told his partner, that Bowden would never finish salvage of the sugar wreck, no matter what the evidence showed, because he believed it was too deep to be the Golden Fleece. After that, there was nothing left to discuss. Matera knew this must be the end for Chatterton. He'd lived with the man for 2 years, knew him better in ways than he did his own brothers. You couldn't ask a person like that, one who'd been willing to swing a sledgehammer around live explosives in a sunken U-boat, to stand down from something that was speaking to him. Something great and rare he believed he could reach.
"So I guess that's it, John,"
Matera said. But Chatterton didn't hear him.
I think there's another way to do this, Chatterton said. I'm coming back.
Chapter 18. The Golden Fleece. The team didn't know about Chatterton's plan when they boarded the Deep Explorer toward the end of February 2009, but one thing was clear. He'd returned to the bay to search. The magnetometer in storage at the villa had been unwrapped and carried aboard. Lying in its wooden cradle, it looked like an old friend to the men. Chatterton fired the engines, then put the boat into a swooping arc away from the villa and on course for the sugar wreck. Matera feared this might happen, that he or Chatterton would finally be pushed too far by Bowden's obstinacy and take matters into their own hands. Mutiny, however, was not an option. The partners liked and respected Bowden and considered him a friend. The pirate project had been Bowden's idea, not theirs, so to go rogue now would dishonor them. And they despised claim jumpers. Matera was about to remind Chatterton of all this when his partner cut the wheel hard to the right, bypassed the sugar wreck, and set course straight for the island. 2 minutes later, they were there.
"What are we doing?" Ehrenberg asked.
"The cannonballs are irrefutable," Chatterton said. "They prove Bannister was at this island. That's the first solid evidence in more than 300 years, since Phipps was here. But we've been so focused on the sugar wreck, we never magged the shore along the island. That changes today."
"What are we looking for?" said Kretschmer.
"I don't know," Chatterton said. "I think we take whatever the island gives us." And with that, the men started a magnetometer survey along the shore. Their work was difficult. The island had an irregular shape, and quirky dipsy-doos and modern debris threatened their sensitive equipment. Chatterton kept the survey tight until all of the island's coast had been covered, even the backside where everyone knew nothing had happened. Survey complete, the team returned to the dive center to process the data. Ehrenberg began to see anomalies on the middle part of the northern side of the island, where Chatterton and Matera believed the battle to have occurred. Everyone's instinct was to gun the Zodiac back to the island and dive the hits, but they waited on Ehrenberg's data. And by the end of the day, they had their survey. A map with electronic X's in places no one had ever looked. The men would have mortgaged future treasure for another 8 hours of daylight, but they had no choice but to wait until morning. And they needed to call Bowden anyway. They sensed they were getting close to something important, and he would want to know. Matera reached him by phone. Bowden said he would be there soon. The next morning, the team moved the boat to the northern shore of Cayo Vigia. A handful of tourists were strolling the bridge that connected the nearby resort to the island, watching the sunrise, as if this had always been the most peaceful place on earth. Kretschmer anchored the boat, then backed in and tied a line from the stern to a palm tree on shore. Then he and Matera lifted the Zodiac from the roof of the boat, dropped it into the water, and used it to hover over the targets from their survey, marking each one of them with a buoy. Chatterton and Ehrenberg suited up, then splashed to check out each hit. In the water, they spotted a mass of stones in the mud, clustered together into the most perfect shape in the shipwreck hunter's world, the pile. This was ballast, assembled from rocks to give a ship stability in the water. It was not accidental, and it was not done by nature. It was from a shipwreck, and it was almost exactly where Bannister would have careened the Golden Fleece. In the mud around the pile, Ehrenberg and Chatterton began to see gallon jugs, many intact, at a depth of around 20 feet. Some appeared to have writing embossed on the sides. Ehrenberg moved one of the jugs toward his mask until he could read the writing. Pearl Street, New York. Other bottles were similar, beautiful, and likely from the 19th century. Too new to have come from the golden age of piracy. But maybe these bottles didn't belong to the wreck that lay underneath the ballast. Perhaps they'd come from a passing ship. The men moved more rock looking for older artifacts, but they found only more bottles. They spent the rest of the day discovering nothing significant.
On the way back to the villa that afternoon, no one said much more than, "Damn, I thought we had her."
By the time the men set out for Kyovigia the next morning, Bowden had anchored his own boat over the sugar wreck. If Chatterton and Matera didn't make good at Vigia now, there was nowhere left to look. In the water, Chatterton and Ehrenberg pushed handheld metal detectors over the shallow bottom, searching for the source of the remaining hits on the survey. Soon, they were hearing faint beeps, and they followed these breadcrumbs of sound to a new rock pile. But when they began moving stones and mud, they found only a steel beam and an old navigation buoy, all modern junk, all just like the stuff they'd spent the last year of their lives finding. Then, something in the distance caught Chatterton's eye, the rippling outline of a pile of stones lying about 12 feet from shore. As he moved toward it, the shape came into sharper relief. It wasn't just a pile of rocks and stones. It was a pile of rocks and stones in the shape of a sailing ship, one big enough to cross oceans. He and Ehrenberg drifted over the pile. From above, they had no doubt this was ballast, and it was massive, about 50 feet long by 40 feet wide. The shallowest part lay in just 6 feet of water, but much of the rest sloped downward. Chatterton checked the depth at the other end of the ballast pile. The reading on his gauge? 24 feet. The men found artifacts right away. A paint can, a lawn chair, a combination lock. But for the first time, they weren't worried by garbage. They dug deeper. Near one end of the pile, Ehrenberg found a 3-foot-long pipe, almost entirely encrusted in coral. Chatterton swam over and motioned, "Let me look." Angling it into the sunlight shimmering down from the surface, Chatterton and Ehrenberg could see through cracks in the pipe's coral encrustation and down to the metal, which was not rounded like pipes should be, but forged into the shape of an octagon. Chatterton left the pipe back on the ballast pile and then swam to the surface. On the boat, dripping and clinging to the ladder, he called to Matera.
"John, you gotta get down there. You need to look at something."
Matera was in the water minutes later. Hovering over the ballast pile, he could see 5 or 6 of the pipes. He picked one up. By its length and heft, he thought it looked like a musket barrel. Matera had decades of experience with guns. He looked closer. To him, the object appeared to have been made in the late 17th century. That's when he remembered what Phipps's men had said about seeing the wreck of the Golden Fleece. There were muskets lying on deck. Matera swam back to the boat. On board, he scrambled for his cell phone.
"Who are you calling?" Chatterton asked.
Matera pointed toward Bowden's boat, which was anchored just 50 yards in the distance. Matera didn't know what to say first. In his hurry, he stumbled over his words, but he finally asked Bowden his questions, which poured out in an unpunctuated stream. Could he and Chatterton recover the pipe, and could they bathe it in muriatic acid to remove the coral and get a better look at the metal? He feared Bowden would want to step in and take over himself, but Matera could not imagine anyone but his own team pulling up first proof of the pirate wreck. Matera hung up the phone.
"We're a go to do it ourselves," he told the others. "Tracy's as excited as we are."
Chatterton slipped his regulator into his mouth and fell back into the water. 3 minutes later he surfaced, cradling the pipe with a midwife's touch. Matera took it from him, gently, and examined it.
"I've seen them in books and shows and auctions," said Matera. "I'm no expert, but I'm telling you, I think that's late 1600s.
Matera snapped a photo of the artifact with his cell phone and attached it to an email he addressed to antique gun experts and collectors he knew. In the subject line, he wrote, "What does this look like to you?" He noted its dimensions and weight in the message field, but said nothing further. Then he pressed send. Piling into the Zodiac, and with Matera cradling the length of iron, the men sped back across the channel to the dive center near the villa, where Kretschmer built a box made of 2x4s and lined it with a thick plastic bag. Ehrenberg poured in about 2 liters of muriatic acid and then, motioning everyone to stand upwind to avoid noxious fumes, took the pipe from Matera and slid it into the bath. Coral broke loose in the acid, turning the liquid brown.
This was shock treatment for an artifact, and likely to damage it. But the pipe could not be preserved in any case without great effort and expense. There were more of them on the ballast pile, and its value in this condition, and without its wood stock, was more evidentiary than monetary. The last of the coral dissolved in 10 minutes. Ehrenberg pulled the pipe from the acid and rinsed it in cold water. Now its octagon shape was obvious.
"That thing wasn't made to move water," Ehrenberg said. "That thing was made to kill."
Matera took the artifact and brought it close to his face. Etched over the length of the metal were elegant swirling patterns, like those he'd seen on hammer-forged musket barrels from centuries past. He didn't know its pedigree, but he knew it was a gun barrel, and he knew it was old. Everyone wanted back in the water now, but Chatterton thought they should wait. It was important to keep Bowden involved, so he had Kretschmer build a small wooden cradle for the gun barrel and secure it using zip ties. Only then did the team get back into the Zodiac and head for Bowden's boat. On the way, Matera received an email reply from Duke McCaw, a longtime dealer in rare and expensive big game rifles and an expert in antique firearms. McCaw had an opinion about the object in Matera's photo. It was a musket barrel, European, dating from the late 17th century. A holler went up from the Zodiac. Matera warned that this was just one opinion, but no one was listening to that, including Matera, and a minute later they were boarding Bowden's boat. Bowden studied the artifact, turning it over in its wood cradle, moving his fingers over its textures and grooves, looking through its hollow barrel.
"How deep did you find this?" he asked.
16 feet, Chatterton said. "But we have others that are deeper." Despite their excitement, Chatterton and Matera knew the gun barrel would not be enough proof. Even if it were period to Bannister's time, that didn't mean it had come from the Golden Fleece. An ironclad case couldn't be made based on just a half-dozen musket barrels and a theory. Kultura and history would need better proof, something no one could argue with, especially with so many competitors closing in. Matera reminded everyone they weren't likely to find a bell embossed with the name Golden Fleece. Most merchant ships of the era didn't carry bells. So a plan was made. Bowden would move his operation to the ballast pile where the muskets had been found. Both crews would work the site, looking for anything that would conclusively prove they'd found the wreck they were looking for. But they would have to wait until the next day to do it. The weather was turning. Chatterton and Matera had waited a year for this, but neither of them felt like he could wait for another tomorrow. There was an antidote to that, of course. The team would go drinking that night, because the next day was likely to be one of the happiest, or most disappointing, days of their lives. By the time they dressed for dinner, Matera had received more replies to his emails, each confirming that the object in his photo was likely a European-made musket dating to the late 17th century. This was cause for celebration, but as the dinner wore on, the mood at the table changed. It wasn't just muskets that couldn't be proved to belong to the Golden Fleece. It was likely true of whatever artifacts they might find. When Chatterton had finally identified the mystery U-boat off New Jersey, he'd done it by pulling a tag from the wreck inscribed with the submarine's number. But there were no tags on 17th-century pirate ships. To get that kind of proof, they would need a bell or something just as good, which meant they'd need something close to a miracle. Of course, this had always been true, but it hadn't really hit them until they'd laid their hands on these muskets. The next morning was too rainy to work. Inside Matera's dive center, the men tried to keep busy, but mostly they swore at the sky. Early that afternoon, Matera's phone rang. It was Bowden.
"I have news," he said. "Meet me at Tony's."
As Chatterton and Matera waited for Bowden at the restaurant, they braced to be told that Kultura had awarded rights to the Golden Fleece to another company, or had taken back parts of Bowden's lease. By now, they'd heard enough treasure-hunting stories to know how many of them ended a day short of the prize. At Tony's, Bowden opened a Ziploc bag and handed the men a piece of paper. It was a photocopied drawing of the battle scene between Bannister's Golden Fleece and the Royal Navy, done by John Taylor, the Falcon's clerk, who'd been aboard the Navy ship during the fight. an eyewitness. It showed a group of masted ships set against a swirling island backdrop and had been sent to Bodin by a historian he'd recently commissioned to do research on the Golden Fleece. The man had discovered the drawing in a newly published book, Jamaica in 1687, by noted historian David Buisseret. Chatterton and Matera could hardly believe what they were seeing. The black-and-white drawing, done in striking detail, showed the Royal Navy's Falcon and the Drake in a small channel facing down Bannister's Golden Fleece, with another ship, the Cheval, nearby. The vessels were beautifully rendered, but it was the topography that struck the men most of all. The Golden Fleece was tucked into the middle of an island, labeled Bannister's Island, that appeared in shape, size, flow, and lines to be Caiovigia. The channel's northern coastline, too, was a match for the real thing, as was the western end of the bay. Just to the east of the Golden Fleece in the drawing, Taylor had labeled a small landmass Hog Island. Chatterton and Matera knew it as Paloma Island, for the hundreds of white doves that roosted there. But it was one and the same. Even the spot on the island where the man placed the Golden Fleece matched the spot where the ballast pile and muskets had been found. In this single drawing, it was as if Taylor had reached back through time and told Chatterton and Matera, "You were right." And there was more. Taylor had written an account of the battle, which was also in the book, though Bowden didn't yet have a copy. "I've got a book dealer in London who will overnight me anything," Matera said. "We'll have it tomorrow." The men got a table and studied the drawing. It did not show a ship in the area of the sugar wreck, between Bannister's Island and Hog Island, but that didn't bother anyone. The sugar wreck, whichever ship she was, had probably sunk early in battle, or was too inconsequential for the eyewitness to draw, or might have been unrelated to the event. But what of the ship Le Cheval? The name was French, but Matera didn't remember reading about a French ship. He did, however, recall that Bannister had worked with several French pirates, including the infamous Michel de Grammont, and that the French pirates had been loyal to him. "Maybe that's how Bannister made his getaway," Chatterton said. "Maybe he escaped on Le Cheval." Chatterton and Matera shook their heads at the luck of it all. An illustration and account of the battle by an eyewitness. Bowden loved the drawing, too, yet he still wished for more proof from the wreck itself. "That," Matera said, pointing outside toward still stormy skies, "is up to the gods." Up early the next morning, Matera walked down to the beach and looked out over the channel, envisioning the Royal Navy frigates and the Golden Fleece where the eyewitness had put them. It all looked like he'd imagined it from his thinking and research. He wondered if the remains of dead seamen and pirates still lay under the mud at the bottom of the channel. Skies were clear, and soon Matera and Chatterton's team, along with Bowden's crew, had anchored over the ballast pile at the middle of the island. Soon there were 9 or 10 divers in the water. Much of the day's work was devoted to moving ballast. Some stones were pebble-sized, others weighed more than 20 pounds. They all required work. The smaller ones could be moved by hand or bucket, but there were thousands of them. Larger ones were carried off by lift bag, a device that used straps and an inflatable bladder to move heavy objects underwater. Big stones had to be handled carefully. If dropped, they could break artifacts buried below. Mud, sand, and coral were sucked up by an airlift, a device that used compressed air and a length of PVC pipe to create a powerful underwater vacuum. As ballast was cleared, the divers began finding artifacts. Many were modern detritus dropped by fishermen, sailors, and tourists, but they also found shards of centuries-old pottery, another musket barrel, and an iron canister, which looked to Bowden like the kind that contained metal shrapnel and was fired by cannons during the Age of Sail. The men were back moving ballast the next morning. Currents made work difficult in the afternoon, so Chatterton and Matera invited Bowden to come onto the island to search for more cannonballs. They expected Bowden to decline. His lease extended only to the waterline, but Matera had had such fun the first time out, he couldn't help but ask. An hour later,
Bowden was pushing with them through brush, sweeping a metal detector around the eastern end of the island. Chatterton found two cannonballs and half of another, which appeared to have sheared on impact. Matera tried to remember if he'd seen Bowden smile like that before. When they returned to the boats in late afternoon, some artifacts had been laid out by divers and rinsed. There were onion bottles, named for their shape, that had once held Madeira wine. One of them was still full. All of it was of historic value. All of it was period to Bannister.
"Save that wine," Ehrenberg said. "We might need it tomorrow."
On March 9th, 2009, the men went back to work on the ballast pile. Digging through mud, one of Bowden's crew saw pieces of burnt orange spackled into the dull greens and tans of the surrounding coral and stone. He put several of these orange pieces into his glove, then surfaced and climbed back aboard the boat. When he removed his glove, the pieces spilled onto a table. These were beads, just like the pirates wore, barrel-shaped and each a quarter of an inch long, orange with fast streaks of black, still as bright as the day they'd been made, still capable of terrifying merchant captains who saw them around the necks or braided into the beards of violent men. But the beads were just signals of what lay below. Divers began to find pikes, cutlasses, daggers, musket balls, cannonballs, sword handles made of coarse bone, and the 15-pound wrought iron blade of a boarding axe, the most fearsome weapon of them all, which pirates used to pull target ships close, cut lines, or, with its gruesome and oversized head, hack at opponents during battle. They could have spent hours admiring each of these pieces, but didn't dare risk missing the chance to find more. They discovered Delftware china, smoking pipes, small hourglass-shaped medicine bottles, sealed by lead tops and with remedies still inside, soles of boots and coins from several countries, as one would expect from pirates who were egalitarian enough to steal from all nations. All of it was historic. All of it was period to the late 17th century. All of it was the stuff of pirates. Near the end of the day, Matera found a simple wood plank, about 3 feet by 1 foot, and with one distinguishing feature. It was burned. Captain Sprague of the Drake, Matera remembered, had returned to the scene of the battle after refitting in Jamaica, only to find the wreck of the Golden Fleece burned to her decks. "I'm holding a piece of Bannister's ship," Matera thought. "I'm holding a piece of the Golden Fleece in my hands." The charred top of the wood disintegrated and blew away in the current. It had remained intact for 323 years, just long enough for Matera to find it. Topside, the divers were thrilled by the quality of their discoveries. "What do you think, Tracy?" Matera asked. Bowden didn't look cautious anymore.
"This is even better than I dreamed," he said. "Guys, we have the Golden Fleece."
The team celebrated that night with dinner at a fine Italian seafood restaurant. One mystery still lingered as the men raised toasts to long-ago pirates, the identity of the sugar wreck. She'd sunk less than 200 yards off the island and was full of period artifacts, mostly Dutch, not one dating later than 1686. The year of the battle. Bowden had always insisted that the sugar wreck lying in 44 feet of water was too deep to be the Golden Fleece, and he'd been proved right. The men raised a toast to Bowden, but if the sugar wreck was not the pirate ship, which vessel was she? And what was she doing there? Bowden had an idea about that. The historian he'd commissioned to research the Golden Fleece had uncovered the log of Charles Talbot, the captain of the Falcon. Talbot had reported firing not just on the Golden Fleece, but on another, smaller ship, a Dutch ship. So maybe the sugar wreck was present during the battle after all.
"Bannister must have taken a Dutch prize before he got to the island," Chatterton said. "The Royal Navy would have sunk a sitting duck like that right away. Maybe that's why the eyewitness didn't draw her."
"Everything fits," Matera said. "That's history." After dinner, the men ferried Bowden back to his boat, but when they returned to shore, they were too excited to call it a night, so they went to the villa for drinks. Sitting on the veranda under a nearly full moon, Chatterton, Ehrenberg, and Kretschmer could see all of Kyovigia, as it must have looked after the first day of battle. Matera joined them, but he wasn't carrying drinks.